Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Bank Fraud Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 23, 2014, the Supreme Court issued its opinion in Loughran versus the United States. The question in this case is whether the government must prove that a defendant intended to defraud a bank and expose it to risk of loss in every prosecution under 18 U.S.C. Section 1344, or whether the government need only prove that a defendant knowingly attempted to defraud someone to obtain any of the monies, funds, credits, assets, securities, or other property owned by or under the custody or control of a financial institution by means of false or fraudulent pretenses, representations, or promises. Justice Kagan delivered the opinion of the court, which held that the government does not need to prove that a defendant charged with violating 18 U.S.C. Section 1344-2 intended to defraud a bank. The judgment of the Tenth Circuit was affirmed. Justice Kagan's opinion was joined in full by the Chief Justice and Justices Kennedy, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor. Justices Scalia and Thomas also joined as to Parts 1 and 2, Part 3A, except the last paragraph, and the last footnote of Part 3B. In addition, Justice Scalia, joined by Justice Thomas, concurred in part and in the judgment, and Justice Alito filed a separate concurrence in part and in the judgment. To discuss the case, we have Todd Bronstein, who is counsel at the law firm WilmerHale. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Bronstein.
Loughran v. United States is the latest in a series of cases in which the Supreme Court was confronted with a criminal statute that, read literally, would greatly shift the balance of power between federal and state criminal jurisdiction. In another such case earlier this term, Bond v. United States, the court gave a narrow reading to a statute banning the possession or use of chemical weapons, holding that it did not apply to a woman who spread poison chemicals on the doorknob of her husband's mistress. In Loughran, decided on June 23rd, the court also adopted a narrowing construction, this time regarding the bank fraud statute. The interpretation adopted by the court was still quite broad. Indeed, it was broad enough to sustain Loughran's own conviction. But it avoided making a federal crime out of every garden variety fraud scheme in which a check was involved. First, some background. The case involved a scheme in which the defendant used altered or forged checks to purchase goods from his local Target store. Often, he returned the goods he had just purchased for cash. The fraud was crude and it was ultimately unsuccessful. Target caught most of the checks before sending them on to the bank and used video surveillance footage to nab Loughran. And because the checks Loughran presented were drawn on federally insured financial institutions, the government decided to charge him with federal bank fraud under 18 United States Code Section 1344. When people hear the term bank fraud, they tend to think that it refers to a scheme to defraud a bank, such as check kiting, loan fraud, or embezzlement by a bank employee. And that is indeed one prong of the federal bank fraud statute. However, the statute includes a second prong, which was at the heart of this case. That clause covers schemes to obtain money or other property that is, quote, owned by or under the custody or control of a financial institution by means of false or fraudulent pretenses, representations, or promises, close quote. Notably, this language does not specify who the object of the fraud must be. Read literally, the requirement seems to be only that there be some scheme to obtain funds owned by or under the control of a bank, and that the means include false or fraudulent pretenses. There is no textual requirement that the scheme be directed at the bank, or even that the bank be a victim of it. This reading of the statute, which might be called the strictly literal reading, has some uncomfortable consequences. In particular, it could be read as making a federal crime out of every fraudulent transaction in the economy involving a check, including cases where no federally insured bank is at risk of loss. Needless to say, such an interpretation would greatly upset the traditional balance between state and federal prosecutors. Hence, Loughran argued, consistently with a number of courts of appeals, the statute contains an implicit requirement that the government prove intent to defraud a bank. On June 23rd, the Supreme Court issued a decision that took something of a middle ground. Justice Kagan, writing for seven justices, held that the false statement must be the mechanism naturally inducing the bank to give up the money or property under its control. The court grounded this test in the requirement that the scheme be effected, quote, by means of false or fraudulent pretenses, unquote. Justice Kagan began her opinion by analyzing why the statute did not support Loughran's argument for an intent to defraud element. First, she relied on the common sense observation that the statute's text contains only the two elements discussed earlier. Nothing in the text of the statute additionally demands a specific intent to defraud a bank. Second, the court held that Loughran's proposed requirement would severely limit the application of this statute to certain fact patterns falling within its literal terms. The court pointed in particular to property owned by a bank but in someone else's custody or control. An example might be a home that a bank entrusted to a real estate company after foreclosure. The court then turned to Loughran's counterarguments as to why the court should disregard the import of the statute's plain text. The court acknowledged that these arguments had some force, but ultimately found them wanting. The first of these arguments relied on the court's construction of comparable language in the federal mail fraud statute. Based on those precedents, Loughran argued that the second prong of the bank fraud statute was merely an illustration of the first prong, not a separate crime. But the court pointed to some textual and historical differences between the mail fraud and bank fraud statute that justified differing treatments. Loughran's second argument relied on principles of federalism, namely the observation that without an intent to defraud requirement, the statute would make a federal crime out of every scheme, no matter how prosaic, that happened to involve payment with a check. The court agreed that it should not lightly assume that Congress meant to effect a significant change in the balance between federal and state criminal jurisdiction. Nevertheless, the court found another way to limit the reach of the statute that did not require it to find an implicit intent to defraud requirement. Specifically, the court held that it is not enough that a false statement operate as a but-for component of a scheme to defraud. Instead, the criminal must acquire or attempt to acquire bank property by means of a misrepresentation. This phrase requires some nexus between the false statement and the acquisition of bank property. As the court put it, quote, Section 1344, subsection 2's by means of language is satisfied when, as here, the defendant's false statement is the mechanism naturally inducing a bank or custodian of bank property to part with money in its control, close quote. That test would be met when a criminal makes false statements directly to the bank. It would also be met in a case like this one, when the defendant offers the check as payment to a third party, which will then be passed to the bank. One situation that would fall outside the statute's coverage was a hypothetical addressed by the court, in which a swindler passes off a cheap handbag as a Louis Vuitton, and his victim pays by a valid check. In such a case, the lie about the Louis Vuitton bag is a but-for cause of the fraudster's acquisition of the bank's funds, but that lie would never make it to the bank. It therefore could not be said to have naturally induced the bank to part with the money. The court's reading here was not necessarily the most plain or natural reading of the text. Instead, it does appear to have been driven by concern about the breadth of the strictly literal reading. Justice Kagan acknowledged as much in a footnote. She said that the interpretation adopted by the court was the best one, quote, for the federalism-related reasons we have given, close quote. This last point was the basis for a brief concurrence filed by Justice Scalia, joined by Justice Thomas. Justice Scalia agreed that intent to defraud was not an element of this crime. He also agreed that the statute should be interpreted, if possible, to avoid federalizing every fraud effected by receipt of a check. But he was dubious of the interpretation that one obtains bank property, quote, by means of a fraudulent statement, only if that statement is the mechanism naturally inducing a custodian of bank property to part with money in its control. He would have left for another day the question of how to limit the statute's sweep. Justice Alito also filed a very brief concurrence to express disagreement with some of the court's dicta. In a sense, Loughran's lawyers won the battle but lost the war. They successfully persuaded the court that for federalism and other policy reasons, the strictly literal reading of the statute should not stand. In this, they were more successful in the Supreme Court than they had been in the Court of Appeals. But because they did not proffer a sufficiently convincing textual hook for their preferred limitation, the court went in a different direction. The court was willing to take a middle ground because of the federalism reasons proffered by Loughran, but it would only do so to the extent it could find some plausible textual grounding. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.